Dennehy, Warner, Coleman, and Goggin. I'm local counsel here today for Appellant Pacific Insurance Company. As this is a re-argument en banc before this honorable court, I would like to reintroduce and introduce for the first time to the court Pro Hoc Vice counsel William Belane from the law firm of Landman, Corsi, Belane, and Ford in New York City, who will be presenting oral argument.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you. Okay.
I apologize for needing the comfort of lots of papers around me. If it pleases the court, I've respectfully reserved 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may. As the court's aware, there's two issues in this case. I'm going to focus on the first, which is the question of whether Liberty Mutual owes a duty to defend Conrail under a comprehensive general liability policy they issued to Julian. The more specific issue in that is the interpretation of a blanket additional insured endorsement, which is in the Liberty policy. It's actually more than one policy, and the council all agrees the same endorsement applies to all of the coverage Liberty may provide. It's found at A167 of the appendix is the endorsement. Not very long, pretty simple. Any organization for whom you have agreed in writing to provide liability insurance, but only with respect to liability arising out of your operations. That's the blanket additional insured endorsement. That's the test that the additional insured has to pass in order to qualify as an insured under the policy. The court below construed the phrase liability arising out of your operations. Let me back up. When we're talking about your operations, the insured on this was a contractor named Julian. Conrail is seeking to be the additional insured. The provision applies only to liability arising out of your, meaning Julian's, operation. And the court below said, well, gee, the only way you're going to get there is if it turns out that Conrail, your liability, is essentially vicarious liability because of the negligence of Julian under respondeat superior and agency theory. What the court failed to do was, I think, to correctly construe that provision arising out of. The court was invited to rely on the Eon Labs decision of this court from the year 2000. The court did not rely on Eon Labs. It didn't cite any law for its interpretation. Eon Labs, we think, certainly is of controlling interest here. It says that this, as a result of, should mean that there has to be a meaningful linkage. That's all. A meaningful linkage between, in our case, the operations of Julian and the liability or prospective liability of Conrail. And by the way, we are only dealing here with duty to defend, not with respect to indemnification issues. In Ian, this court was actually, and this is actually...
Before you get to the arising out of argument, your opponent has said the agreement to provide liability insurance does not include a specific type of liability insurance. Was that argued before the Superior Court?
I don't think it was, Your Honor. You'll have to ask the other counsel. And I think, as you've seen from our brief, our riposte to that is whether or not you argued it before. That's funny. You don't even bother to define the word liability in your policy in a way that might justify what position you've just taken. And once we look at common ordinary meaning for the word liability, it sure looks to us like a railroad protective liability policy is a liability policy.
Mr. Belane, two questions. You argued that all that's required is a meaningful linkage, and I gather that's a linkage between the Julian operations and what?
And Conrail's liability, the basis on which they are being sued in the underlying two wrongful death actions.
All right, and your contention is, of course, that there is a meaningful linkage because?
Two ways. First, unambiguously, we would say that there's a meaningful linkage between the alleged negligence of Julian and the alleged negligence of Conrail, that in combination they caused the injuries and deaths of the decedent plaintiffs in the wrongful death action. All you have to do is look at the pleadings, and you're going to see that Julian is charged with working at and around the grade crossing. Conrail's responsible for the grade crossing. Julian's responsible, according to this, for work both around the grade crossing and at the grade crossing. Julian is charged with creating a dangerous condition. Conrail is charged with not only creating a dangerous condition, but that they should have known that conditions were created and they failed to remedy it, from which the logical inference is, even if you didn't create the condition, Conrail, you've got to be aware that Julian has created that condition. Then when you look at the particular allegations, the very specific allegations against both Julian and Conrail, you're going to see a complete intertwining. You're going to see that they say in the underlying cases that Julian failed to use flagmen around the work site and crossing. Conrail failed to use flagmen. The pleadings say Julian failed to inspect the work site, and the work site would include the crossing based on the pleadings. They say in the pleadings, Conrail failed to inspect the areas surrounding the crossing. The pleadings say Julian failed to provide adequate lighting at and around the work site. The pleadings say Conrail failed to light the crossing. It goes on. Julian failed to post adequate warning signals. Conrail was responsible for defective flashing lights. Julian didn't test the warning signals and lights. Conrail failed to test the flashing lights. All of these things are interlinked, and it's not surprising, because when you think about this logically, it was the combination of the problems. If Julian had committed no negligence, we might not be here today. So that's the first argument, that we'd say there's a combination, there's clearly a combination of negligence by both.
Can I stop you there?
You may.
Your description of the allegations against Julian and Conrail sound very much like what you would expect to see in a negligence claim where there are multiple defendants saying, you did it, and you did it, and you did it, and you were all doing the same thing wrong, which is the which resulted in my client being injured, in this case, being killed. Are you telling us that any time two parties are charged with the same allegedly negligent conduct, that makes the meaningful linkage? Isn't it just as easy to say, two independent entities were both doing things that were allegedly negligent at the same place? Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they were linked to each other.
Well, my answer to your question, and I always worry about generalizing, but my answer would be, yes, it does mean that for pleadings purposes. We're talking about two different things. Right now, we're talking about a duty to defend, to undertake. And we're saying, looking at these pleadings, we don't know how the case is going to develop, but looking at these pleadings, it's clearly finding a combination of negligence by two distinct parties. And I think, by the way, it's uniquely so in this particular case.
Well, what I'm trying to understand better is whether linkage means the two parties have to have done something together. So we're both working at the same work site, and you're being sloppy, and I'm handing you the wrong stuff, and then people get injured. Here, the allegations, as I understand them, are two parties who seem to have nothing to do with each other are both at the same location with independent duties to be careful.
I think Liberty would like, Your Honor, to conclude that, but I don't think you can conclude that from the pleadings, and I don't think it makes sense to conclude that from the pleadings. If you look at the pleadings, and Conrail has a duty, for example, to inspect around the area of the crossing, doesn't that tell you that Conrail's duty is because Julian's doing a lot of work there? and because Julian may have created a dangerous condition that now requires Conrail to do something more than they would have had to do if Julian wasn't there in the first place. It may indeed, according to the pleadings, have obligated Conrail to put a flagman there. Does Conrail ordinarily have to put a flagman there? I'll represent it doesn't, but the point would be that they are affirmatively saying you had to do some things because you had to recognize what was going on all around this crossing, including the crossing. So I don't view them as two different separate people at all. And indeed, DelDOT didn't. I mean, the whole thing is an integrated project that includes the crossing. So that would be my best answer to Your Honor. Now, I do want to say in addition that, frankly, I think that there is at least an ambiguity in the provision that should be construed most strongly against Liberty as to whether we would be entitled to a duty to defend even if Julian was not negligent. And for that proposition, I will simply refer to the court to the cases that we cite on 24 and 25 in the brief, including a Tenth Circuit decision in McIntosh, includes a Fifth Circuit decision in Mid-Continental, which also discusses a number of other cases. And indeed, it includes a case called Acceptance Insurance in California, which was cited in a footnote by this court in Ian. And those cases stand for the proposition that you can have a causal connection, an arising out of situation, even if the other party isn't negligent, because it's closer to a but-for, that if they hadn't been there doing what they were doing, you wouldn't be liable here today. And so I think that also applies here. Now, in Ian, the policy was considered to be unambiguous because of the factual context the court was presented with. I would suggest, Your Honor, that we win as a matter of law based on that. But further, in the context of our case, we also win because if there is an ambiguity, and there is, it has to be resolved in our favor. And so it even extends to a situation where you can assume that Julian did nothing wrong. Now, you don't have to assume that and shouldn't assume that from the pleadings. There are a number of arguments that Liberty makes. I think I've briefly touched on what Justice Ridley mentioned, which is the whole issue of, well, gee, this isn't liability insurance. I'm sorry, the Railroad Protective Policy isn't liability insurance, so we didn't agree in writing to provide liability insurance. I think that's easily dealt with. There's a cite they make to office structures for the proposition that you can't breach a contractual obligation to provide liability insurance and thereby enlarge the insurer's liability. I've never been sure what that means, and when they cited to office structures, they didn't cite to a particular page in office structures. But all I'm going to say is this. Look at the endorsement they drafted. They are the sophisticated insurers. Either we fit within their language in the endorsement or we don't. We say we clearly do. I think they may briefly try to argue that Ian is not Delaware law. I'll let Your Honors determine for yourselves whether it is. I think the principles in Ian apply with full force to this case. They argue that, gee, there's no reasonable expectation here of insurance for Conrail because of the insured contract exclusion. They are mixing apples and oranges. The insured contract exclusion has nothing to do with this because we are saying we are Conrail. If we're right and we're an additional named insured, then we want coverage not because of contractual liability we've assumed, but because somebody has charged us with a tort. And so the contractual liability exclusion has nothing whatsoever to do with it. Now, they also say, well, gee, Conrail sure never intended to be covered. Well, I'll certainly concede we didn't intend to have to rely on the coverage under the comprehensive general liability policy. We had expected coverage under the Railroad Protective Policy. But Julian certainly, looking at this, had every expectation that this provision was going to cover an entity just like Conrail. And if you'll forgive me for speculating, I can't help but wonder if they didn't decide to dispense with getting the Railroad Protective Policy insurance they should have gotten, because they had a nice blanket insurance endorsement that sure seemed to provide the coverage that Conrail could have asked for. Then we get to the issue of the Delaware Code and what overlay that has. Title 6, 2704. Since Justice Ridgely asked a similar question before, to my knowledge, this is a defense that was not raised below by Liberty, and you can inquire of Liberty as to whether they did. But they now say, actually at the end of their brief on appeal, gosh, how can you have an expectation of coverage when under 2704 you're not allowed to be indemnified for your own negligence or any part of your own negligence? You couldn't have an expectation.
In your position, assuming this was argued below, right, is that statute applies essentially to construction contracts. It doesn't apply to contracts.
Exactly. And B is beautifully broad. Nothing shall be construed to void or render unenforceable policies of insurance, that's us, issued by duly authorized insurance companies, that's us, and insuring against losses or damages for any causes whatsoever, that's us. Straightforward.
I know that you wanted to focus your argument on the first issue, but I would like it in the time that you have if you would just briefly summarize your position as to the second issue.
Yes, with respect to the second issue. Yes, sir. In some measure, to be perfectly candid, our position on the second issue is a function of how the court views the first issue. We have always assumed that you're supposed to give a broad reading of allegations in a contract, construe them in favor of coverage, and then determine whether there's at least a duty to defend. We have argued in our second point with respect to the duty to defend under the force account policy that if we're going to apply the kind of interpretation that the lower court applied to the first issue, then you're going to have to find more in the pleadings than exist in order to say that coverage under the force account policy was triggered. To trigger that coverage, you have to be able to look at the pleading and say, okay, the claim of negligence against Conrail relates to work performed for governmental entities where the named insured is reimbursed. And we go back to the pleadings and we say, is there something in the pleadings that discloses to the reader that, yes, the kind of complaints they're making about Conrail relate to work performed, or I will acknowledge work they failed to perform that should have been performed, that concern work for the government, for DelDOT, for which they were going to be reimbursed by DelDOT. When you look at the tick list of the failures that I recited earlier, we are respectfully submitting that absent something more in the pleading, you have to conclude or should conclude that if Conrail failed to inspect the area around it, failed to use flags, failed to light the crossing, failed to test the flashing bulbs, it's not clear that that has anything to do with the work they were doing for Delta. Because after all, they always have a duty. Even before this project started and after this project is over, they have a duty to decide, do I need a flag person that's crossing? Are the lights working? Is the lighting adequate at the site? Those kinds of issues. Well, so that's really the...
What does the complaint disclose, was the work required by DelDOT?
The complaint doesn't. The underlying wrongful death action complaints do not disclose anything that specifically would inform the reader. Oh, obviously here they're talking about work that Conrail was performing or was supposed to be performing for Delta.
Well, don't the principles that you're asking us to apply on the first issue to reverse require us to affirm on the second issue?
I sure hate to say a flat yes, but I'm as close as I could be to admitting that. I think for both of us, this has sort of been a fascinating topsy-turvy argument where we just have to argue opposites with respect to each of them. I do think it is, if I can escape the flat yes, I'd say it is even easier to find a duty to defend under the first issue than it is to find a duty to defend under the second issue. Is that a small enough evasion that you'll accept it?
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I would, if I may.
You have 5 minutes and 25 seconds.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
May it please the Court. Susan Listowski on behalf of the defendant below, appellee Liberty Mutual. As my colleague pointed out, there is an issue regarding whether or not Conrail falls as an additional insured under the blanket insured provision of the Liberty Mutual policy. And I think a lot has to, the background has to be established in this because it's not as simple as my colleague would like you to believe. Liberty Mutual insured Julian. The contract between Del Dot and Julian provided for very specific things that Julian was supposed to do. That was to widen, rebuild, reconfigure, and resurface the road surface. Del Dot also had a contract in place with Conrail, and Conrail was supposed to do certain things with that same railroad crossing. Widening the crossing itself, relocating warning lights and poles, installing cantilevered arms for overhead lights, installing new rails and new circuitry. These are two separate requirements of each of the contractors there, Conrail and Julian. Specific wants you to overlook one fact that the Superior Court noted, and that was that force work was actually being done by Conrail because the contract called for force work to be performed by Conrail at this location. Pacific would like to lump everything in together and say, because there was so much of an overlap of the work being done, because the work was being performed at the exact same location during around the same time, it has to arise out of Julian's operations. But there's one key thing that we're missing here. There's been no determination ever as to what actually caused these accidents. So while my colleague would like to say, we wouldn't be here today if Julian didn't do something wrong, that's not what the complaint alleges. The complaint not only alleges that Conrail had specific responsibilities in performing some of the operations, it also alleges broader things, such as the conductor of the train may have done something improperly.
But in our inquiry, don't we have to start a little earlier? We're talking about the duty to defend. And, you know, the other side says we look at the complaint, because when someone gets the complaint, they have so many days to answer the complaint. They need a lawyer. They need to know who their lawyer is going to be. What's the focus of our inquiry there? Everything you're talking about seems to relate to facts that would be developed during discovery when hopefully you have a lawyer who's defending you.
Well, I think the problem is the Pacific is reading into the complaint things that aren't there, and that is the specific allegation that any of Conrail's negligence, as of have been alleged in the complaint, arises out of Julian's operations. But that's not what the complaint says. And when you have to look at the complaint, and there are allegations, and it's admitted that there's allegations in the complaint that deal with Conrail's separate negligence, Conrail's separate obligations under the complaint, I don't think you can read into the complaint that if Conrail had separate obligations, Conrail had separate responsibilities under the contract, that somehow arises out of Julian's operations.
But the complaint alleges, at least that with respect to some of the claims, that the work that was done at the accident site that led to the accidents was being done both by Julian and by Conrail. If that's the case, then don't you have at least one claim that triggers coverage, whether or not the other claims do or don't?
I don't think you do, and this is why I don't think you do. If you look at the actual allegations of the complaints, as they're alleged to Conrail and Julian, there are some overlapping from the standpoint of failing to employ a flagman. But look at the entire wording of all these allegations. On page 8126 of the appendix to the appellant's brief, the specific allegations against Julian have to do with things it did in and around its work site. It's specifically focusing on its work site. When you turn to Conrail's, the allegations against Conrail, it's those specific allegations, and a lot of them are the same because they are the failure to warn. They are the failure to post adequate warning devices. Right, but
are you arguing that the claims of wrongdoing by Conrail and the claims of wrongdoing by Julian are separate and are hermetically sealed off from each other, and there's no construction of the complaint that could lead to any overlap?
I am. I don't think there is any construction of the complaint. And that goes back to, look at the wording of the complaint. It's
all right, well, let's look at a hypothetical so that we can think about how the law would develop in the future. In my hypothetical, let's assume count one said Julian was negligent because. Count two said Conrail was negligent because. Count three said Julian and Conrail together were negligent because. How would you decide a duty to defend case?
Well, assuming for the purposes, and I haven't addressed this yet, that we agree under the insurance policy here that the failure to provide insurance, liability insurance, would be the Railroad Protective Liability Insurance, which I haven't touched on yet, and I will do so shortly. Assuming that is the fact, if in fact the allegations are that Conrail's negligence arises out of things that Julian was performing, that is, the work that Julian was performing, then it does fall under the insurance. If it just says Conrail and Julian were jointly negligent, I think there's still a question as to whether or not is it arising out of Julian's operations.
Well,
I think that has to be pled.
I'd like to focus at A128, paragraphs 16, 17, and 18, and just starting with 16. At said time and place, defendant Consolidated Rail Corporation knew or should have known that a dangerous condition had been created and failed to remedy that condition. Doesn't that infer created by Julian?
No. Look up at paragraph 13. At that paragraph, it talks about bushes, undergrowth, and other vegetation obstructing the view. Why couldn't that paragraph be read that they should have known that a dangerous condition was created because overgrowth of vegetation?
If there are two ways to read these paragraphs, don't they have to be read in favor of the insured?
I think obviously any ambiguity has to be read in favor of the insured, but I think at that point you look at the intentions of the parties. And this court in the the Superior Court case in the Daimler-Chrysler, which is cited in our brief, specifically says you have to some extent look to the intents of the parties. The factual scenario here was that Julian obtained from Liberty Mutual quotes for Railroad Protective Liability Insurance. They never followed through and actually purchased Railroad Protective Liability Insurance. The intent of every party here, including Julian, was not that this general liability coverage would provide coverage in such assistance in involving Conrail's alleged negligence. The Railroad Protective Liability Insurance was supposed to provide, and
is what you're telling us now in the record?
It's in the record. Yes, it is. It's in the record below.
Well, your opponent was speculating that after getting these quotes for the specific railroad coverage, that, you know, there's speculation that perhaps Julian said, well, we can save the money because we've already got this other policy we're paying for. Now, I understand that's a circumstantial argument that's not supported by the record. But you're telling us, in the record, it's absolutely clear Julian got these quotes, knew it had a contractual obligation to get the insurance, then made a deliberate decision not to buy it.
I don't know if it was a deliberate decision, Your Honor. I can tell you there was a decision made not to follow through. Whether it was negligent or whether it was deliberate, I don't think was ever decided. But the record below, the Julian representatives were in fact deposed and did in fact state that they got the quotes from Liberty Mutual. I believe the quotes themselves are part of the record below, and that they never followed through with getting it. And quite honestly, I don't think we would be here today if Conrail had jumped on the gun a little bit earlier and noticed that Julian failed to procure this this insurance. There's
we wouldn't be here if Julian had done what it was supposed to do.
Exactly, and that's, I think that's...
that is,
yeah, we
may.
Wouldn't be here if there weren't any accidents either, so let's, let's get to where we are.
Be that as it may, one of the, I'd like to hear your response to one of the specific claims of error that was argued here today, and that is that the Superior Court erroneously held that for the claim to arise out of Julian's operation, the relationship between Conrail and Julian would have to be one of either agent or employee. In other words, there would have to be a vicarious liability of Conrail for acts performed by Julian. The argument advanced here is that that was error because the only linkage that's required is a meaningful linkage, not a vicarious liability relationship. What is your response?
I think, first of all, that is a very narrow reading that my proponent is offering of the court below's interpretation. The court expressed that one of the reasons why Conrail could be held responsible would be vis-a-vis vicarious liability. But it goes on to talk about the relationship that it arises out of or result from Julian's operations, and that the liability of Conrail, and this is a direct quote from page 27 of the court's decision, the liability of Conrail is not premised on its relationship with Julian. And I think that's what it is.
So let me rephrase the question. This court is being asked to write an opinion in which the critical rule of law on this issue is that there has to be a meaningful linkage between Conrail's liability and Julian's operations. And from that premise, we would then proceed to analyze the facts as they're alleged in the complaint. Is that premise correct or not? And if it isn't, why not?
I think it is correct to some extent, and this is the difference.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
I mean, if it's correct to some extent, then...
It's correct that there has to be a meaningful link, and I just want to stress that this clause in this policy, unlike some of the other clauses that have been cited in the matter, throw in the word only, and that word only has to be read in connection with the entire policy. So it's arising only out of Julian's operations. I don't think you can just say there has to be a meaningful link. It has to arise solely. That meaningful link has to arise solely out of Julian's operations. Going back to the issue of the
All right, so you're not contending that there has to be a vicarious liability relationship as far as Conrail is concerned?
I'm not. And I don't think the court below specifically said that. I think the court below used that as an example. They talked about the relationship. They did not use the words meaningful link. I will concede that. There's the other allegations regarding the failure to procure the liability insurance, and I submit that liability insurance is not a defined term under the insurance policy. But this railroad protective liability insurance has been created federally in a statutory manner to get around a lot of things. And one of the things it's supposed to get around are insurance contract provisions that deal with and exclusions that deal with the work or construction work that is being performed within 50 feet of the railroad. That's a pretty standard.
And you're arguing before us that railroad protective liability policy was not liability insurance as contemplated by this additional insured section. Was that argued to the Superior Court?
It was, Your Honor. It was argued.
Not addressed in the opinion.
It was not addressed in the opinion. And the argument was twofold. And if you look at the contract between the parties, the contract specifies some...
Can you identify where it was argued?
Yes. The contract between the parties are at A218 and A219. And A218 is actually where the insurance policy contracts are required. There's two requirements that Julian have enforced, and this is the contract between DelDOT and Julian, that Julian have enforced, not in anybody else's name, but in its own name, public liability insurance and protective public liability insurance. They met that burden by obtaining the general liability insurance policy, which is subject to scrutiny today. There's also a separate requirement in that policy that they that in Conrail's name, they purchase railroad protective public liability insurance. And I would submit to you that that is different because it's a federally mandated, it's not known to us to be different, but in the insurance industry, in the industry of Conrail, DelDOT, and in the industry of Julian, these people that work with these things on a daily basis, that's a very specific requirement.
Your point is, if you wouldn't need the third policy if it was covered by the first two.
No, I don't necessarily know if that is the case. No, I don't think that is the case at all. The third policy is required. It's not only required by the contract, it's required by federal law that they have to have railroad protective liability insurance. And that railroad protective liability insurance doesn't have to be in Julian's name, has to be in Conrail's name.
No, I understand that, but I'm trying to understand whether your argument is that there would be an overlap in coverage or the requirement for three types of insurance somehow supports your argument that they were different, and that's why the first two policies don't control here.
And that is, but the second argument is what I'm saying. The first two insurance requirements, the requirement for public liability requirement, those insurance, those are the type of insurance that are required, and those are the type of the insurance that the additional insured language, the blanket insured language, would pertain to. It doesn't pertain to procuring a railroad protective liability insurance.
I understand, but let me ask this more simply. If Conrail was covered by the first two policies, which is the contention in this appeal, then the third policy would have been unnecessary.
Well, no, because the third policy also required additional coverage, additional monetary value. The first two policies only recovered coverage of $2 million. The last one recovered $6 million. So irregardless, they didn't comply with the contract agreement, and it wouldn't have met the contract terms just by procuring this general liability. I also think it's important that the third contract, to some extent, requires Conrail to be identified as a named insured, and I think when you, in that requirement being how this is a blanket insured, which is subject to scrutiny provisions, I think that Conrail should have been as a named insured in the third contract.
What is the principal authority you rely upon for your argument that railroad protective liability policy is not liability insurance?
I would just submit to you that that's the history of the legislation history based upon the legislative requirement that it is required under all contracts between contractors performing work in or about a railroad.
So no case law supports that at this point?
That's correct. To my knowledge, that has never been addressed.
Let me ask you a question that goes to the construction itself so I can conceptualize what's actually going on in relation to meaningful linkage of Julian's work and Conrail's work. Is it correct that Conrail didn't have a sealed off area where its tracks crossed the roadway within which only it did work? Is it correct that Julian did the asphalt across the railroad tracks and therefore worked at some point within the crossing controlled by Conrail?
That's correct.
So if there were an allegation that Conrail had failed to properly warn the public of a danger within that work area, it could conceptually have been as a result of what Julian was doing within their crossing, correct?
Sure. I don't think that's what the complaint alleges, though. I mean, I really, you've got to look at the allegations in the complaint. And
the common sense applies to the allegations. We all live in a world where we've seen railroad crossings and asphalt rehabilitation of roadways that either cross the crossing or the crossing crosses the highway, one or the other.
Sure, Your Honor. And And honestly, the allegations that are alleged in the complaint as to Conrail would be the same type of allegations that would be alleged to Conrail if there was no construction going on at this crossing. If there was a crossing that, you know, somebody went over and was injured for one way or the other. Those are the type of allegations that are alleged.
In looking at the allegations in the complaint for the purpose of determining whether there's a duty to defend, though, don't we read them in every way they could be read? Because we don't know, as I think the justices pointed out in earlier questions, we don't know how they will actually be read until the facts are developed through discovery or even live testimony.
And understandably, obviously, any ambiguity once again has to be resolved in favor of the insured. But I think once again you're circumventing also the intent of the parties
in
this matter.
And these accidents occurred during a period of construction, correct?
Correct.
So when they occurred, there was intermingled work between Julian working on the roadway and Conrail working on the configuration and the structures within the railroad crossing.
That's correct.
Okay.
And once again, I would just stress the fact that the intent of the parties and the intent of Liberty Mutual was not to provide coverage to Conrail for any allegations of negligence. And that's why the railroad protective insurance was supposed to be procured. I very briefly.
Well, I thought the railroad protective insurance was supposed to be procured because federal law demanded it, because Liberty Mutual thought it was going to be procured.
It is because it was federally mandated, but it was also, I mean, Liberty Mutual obviously relied. They evaluated these policies beforehand. Somebody contacted them from Julian and said, we want a quote on this. We want to make sure this complies with the policy. This is all part of the record below of our requirements under the insurance contract. And they were given, Liberty Mutual gave to Julian.
The language in the policy doesn't say except for entities or third parties covered by federally mandated railroad insurance.
It doesn't. But then you're looking at the insured contract provisions and the exclusion of the insured contract. Once you assume the liability of another, that's an insured contract under the insurance policy. And once you assume the liability of the other, another, and you're an insured contract under the insurance policy, there's an exclusion for work performed within 50 feet of the railroad.
Okay.
I just want to briefly touch on Pacific's second argument regarding their duty to defend in this matter. And I just want to very briefly, Pacific mentioned in their papers filed that they agreed that force work personnel were to relocate and reinstall lights at this intersection. One of the allegations at paragraph 20B of the complaint, and this is on page A29 of the appendix, is that Pacific improperly placed flashing lights, warning signs, and other warning signals at the railroad highway grade crossing. Obviously, if the force work personnel were on site and one of their responsibilities was to relocate and reinstall lights, and one of the exact, we don't have to look beyond anything other than 20B, at A29, one of the exact allegations in the complaint is that they improperly placed those lights. I think your question is done there, and I think it's clear that at that point, force work is being performed, and it falls within Pacific's contract obligations under their insurance. If there's nothing, I'm done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will not require the full 5 minutes. It's obvious to me from the court's questioning that every time I wrote a little note about something I wanted to address, I thought follow-up questioning from the court did a better job of addressing it than I could. The one issue about whether that question of what does liability insurance mean, whether it was argued below, I don't doubt Liberty's counsel. I think she's been involved in the case throughout. I was not involved with this case going back to 2003, 2004. I don't know if the court would like, perhaps, counsel and I could confirm that the argument was raised below and then write a joint letter to the court if it matters to the court on that subject.
We take the representation of Delaware counsel on that
Fine.
Issue.
That's fine. I guess I'll wrap up by saying we had a series of we wouldn't be here today if questions, and the only wouldn't be here today if question that wasn't tossed out was the one that I think is dispositive against Liberty, is we wouldn't be here today if they drafted their blanket endorsement differently, that if they truly contemplated there was going to be railroad protective liability coverage, and that's not what they're talking about in here, then they would have put something in this endorsement. They would have added something to this endorsement to make that clear. Instead, we've got the word liability insurance, which is nowhere defined, and it's fascinating to me because when you see liability insurance in the first paragraph, it's got a capital L, which typically means you've got to run around and find a definition somewhere else in the policy where they'll define liability. And I remember when I first saw it, I said, oh, my goodness, they've got something here where it's not defined in the policy. And if your honors want to briefly just take a look later at A173, an additional insured endorsement for revision, you can see that there's typed in information there that demonstrate that a sophisticated insurer will know. I mean, it's a different context, but the point is that if a sophisticated insurer is acting under an apprehension that, well, gosh, this blanket endorsement shouldn't cover a railroad protective policy, then they will put something in. They'll type something into the blanket endorsement to cover it, and they didn't do that here.
Could I interrupt for a second?
You may.
What about the insured contract exclusion, the 50-foot from the...
Right.
What impact does that have?
It has nothing to do with the case. The only time that exclusion comes into play is when the coverage sought is based on liability assumed under contract. So that... if Conrail is going to Liberty and saying, I'm covered for these two wrongful death actions because I assumed liability under contract, then those exclusions come into play and we're out. And that particular exclusion is in there, frankly, because historically, there were railroad sidetrack agreements that for years and years and years would make sure that the owner of railroad of crossings would not would be able to get indemnified from people who used the crossing. So they always had indemnification agreements, and at some point along the way, the insurers decided, you know what, we want to exclude from coverage anything that happens within 50 feet. But the premise of the coverage always was that the railroad was stepping up and saying, I didn't do anything wrong, but I'm being sued, and the good news is that I've got a sidetrack agreement that indemnifies me, and the indemnitor is the person that's really responsible for this, if that helps to explain it. And that, by the way, was one of the other bases that the trial court below did give. I think, unfortunately, the court was misled by the arguments of Liberty on that. Unless the panel has any further questions, we'll stand on our arguments in the papers. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement.